Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
home. Tonight we are discussing a most interesting aspect in law. I'm Michael Edward. I'll be both your moderator and your host for this evening's conference call, brought to you by Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it's important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing you hear in this call tonight may in any way, shape, or form be deemed by you to be legal advice, financial advice, even advice for the lovelorn. If you're on this call because of a situation in your life where you're requiring legal advice, I ask you very politely and most sincerely, you hang up on this call. Just disconnect the call. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when I say this. I just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business being here on any of these calls. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the other programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you legal advice. Now, should you require legal advice, my suggestion, not advice, my suggestion would be to get an attorney, someone your state sanctions to give advice in law. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes, just people saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you and your particular situation. You might get a little bit of education on it, but mainly you're just going to talk to folks and get their opinions about what they might do were they similarly situated. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they're just people's opinions, nonetheless. It's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, let's go to the next subject. Let's go over a few things here with your remedy and is in the law very quickly. First of all, I'll take everyone to the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com. Look at the upper right-hand corner. You'll see a little picture of our Constitution, our federal Constitution. Click on that, and a separate place will come up with just two items on it. These two items are certainly most important, though especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is a 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known as American Jurisprudence or AmJur. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests, the vehicle it operates through. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means that you have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in any virtually court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, nationally known for its high win rates in traffic cases throughout the country. At least, that's what it is and it's mostly acquired for. However, this is not really why it's on this page. The reason we have the common law default process up here in the jurisdictionary course is that when you go through this course, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it's kind of like a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time to committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate in traffic scenarios being such a common problem in this country today. The common law default process, although known for traffic purposes, has many other remedy applications for most scenarios that you find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some government official claiming you've broken one of their rules, and therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very reasonably priced. The jurisdictionary course with a contribution of $250, the common law default course with a contribution of $150. Also, on the subject of your remedy is in the law, you're probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you're met with the blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to that site or that you were visiting or just stay here and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we're doing this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that are at Your Remedies in the Law. YourRemediesInTheLaw.com is just one of a couple of dozen plus websites that altogether comprise, under the umbrella, Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. Should you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you the best personal educated opinion about what your particular situation requires, email me at mm@yourremediesinthelaw.com or call 1-800-625-4250. And we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we're able. Grassfire Communications, formerly known as Statewide Communications, if you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's the map of the United States that you see virtually on every website that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables you to speak with one another on a local level base on a very strict, pre-decided topic of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. It's actually a very easy setup, you know, continue here, click next, that, put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. And then the assistant will walk you through the remainder of the setup. You will then get to a point where it will ask you, what are your interests? What are you interested in? This could range anywhere from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of that if it affects your personal life in one way or another, you should find it in that list of something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, the software puts this all together, much like you would think of a social network. Now, not that it is a social network, it's really, truly very custom, very private. It then puts you in contact with people in your local venue, where you live, that have common interests to you. People you most likely would never have met otherwise. Now you found them. They found you. Simply because you're both members of AmericansRestoringAmerica.com. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back into the hands of the common man. Imagine were you to go to a county council meeting alone, your newfound friends who agree with you on this particular standing on this issue now show up with you. This could not be just 6 or 8 or 10 people. We're talking tens, hundreds of people, easily. Possibly thousands. If you're in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal matters, their personal opinions with people that were like-minded. Example, you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, it's sympathetic, but it's probably not going to be a tremendous help to you. And then the next person chimes in, well, I tell you what I would do if I were similarly situated, I'd watch these YouTubes, here's the links, and then I'd go down to my local courthouse, go to their law library, and get a law dictionary and look up these terms. Then perhaps the next person after that says, well, that all sounds, you know, like great ideas. And also, there's this particular website you should check out, these educational materials that might assist you in learning. And then you could go and do some of your own due diligence on what you're reading. Just people, that's what this is, offering suggestions, people's opinions. But if you just do your due diligence and educate yourself, maybe the farther you get into it, you discover that it's not all that difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. You get to a point where you've investigated the matter yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that, and that's what we're all trying to do here at Grassfire Communications. It becomes very simple to get people to start talking again amongst themselves. Of course, there is no cost for using Grassfire Communications, either signing up or its regular use of it. So hopefully you'll pass this around. On the side, we do appreciate any generations and donations on your part, but that's not necessary. If that is not an option for you today, well, then there's freedomsradio.com. If you're on the road, you don't want to deal with the card process, the debit card and so forth, your remedy is in the law. You don't have your username and password, and therefore you can't see the phone and the PIN. So, by the way, if you want to pick up the membership of yourremediesinthelaw.com, it's very easy. You simply click on the register button, and so that's your basic information. You enjoy the first 30 days for free evaluating it. You don't even ask for a debit card at that point. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your bank card or your PayPal. Did you know that every single call is recorded? There are years of archives to go through. There's a vast wealth of knowledge that, as well there as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, the $10 a month, you have freedomsradio.com every night. The calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, and they're live. Now and then we'll have a recording when one of us gets ill, an emergency comes up, we can't make the call, we'll throw in a recording, but for the most part, the calls are all live. There's also the question box there where you can type in a question at Freedoms Radio. You click submit as long as it's within the certain call hours. Your written question will pop up on the moderator's screen, and we do our best to read every single one of these questions out over the years as long as they're appropriate. So you don't get to talk directly with the information provider through Freedoms Radio like you would being on a private as a private member or directly on the phone call, but you do get to get your questions answered, and there's no cost to utilize freedomsradio.com. So no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, your buyer beware. Your remedies in the law is under the umbrella of Americans Restoring America. When you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you're doing just that. Information providers pay advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with many other expenses that might be associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Unless you're one of those government alphabet agencies, then you can find anybody, unless you don't want to find them. Then we make those introductions. Not all teaching efforts by the information providers are always going to be successful. Everyone always hopes for the best. We plan for the best and believe you aim for the best. Unfortunately, bad things do sometimes happen. You have judges that are not willing to follow the law. There are the remedies for that, but, you know, it just makes it for a tedious fight. And when they do, you have to wrestle with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in your life. Again, we also want to emphasize the intent. The intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions about that, we welcome you to visit yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at your remedies in the law anyway. Of course, when you call in and you go with a particular information provider, that's exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider. And even then, that's very few and far between. It takes some really extenuating circumstances. There must be extreme circumstances. You're expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all the information providers at your remedies in the law, we've got to remind everyone that all of our speakers on these conference calls are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that the speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, you know, rebuttal. But please, you must always be civil. The question you pose, properly posed, and then answered properly, well, if that's all done, then we can all learn something from it. All right. Well, that is my rant for this evening. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over this evening to myself, the speaker's host, and it will be with our great pleasure that we bring in forward Brother John, who's going to be sharing something with you tonight. Very, very interesting. It's one of my favorite subjects. In fact, John and I speak on this pretty often. And that is appearance versus representation. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Brother John. Go ahead, buddy.
Thank you for that very kind and gracious introduction, Michael. And as Michael so candidly, succinctly pointed out, that he and I may cuss and discuss and argue and debate and debate this subject quite often. In fact, we even spent some time today on it, and it's a regular point of genuine concern for anybody that may find themselves with an invitation to discuss an issue before a bench. And if you get one of those invitations, it's very, very important that you understand the gravity of what this is. Now, when you come into court, a lot of times they'll say, where's your attorney, or do you have an attorney? And do you have an attorney representing you? And they'll use the word representing you, and they'll I've almost always had any judiciary that makes a point of this, they say it's your constitutional right. Okay, that's kind of true. And what happens is that as a direct issue of the Constitution, the Sixth Amendment is where you would like to focus on. And it's something that's extremely important that you, when you look at the Sixth Amendment, that you look at the issue about what they say is that you have the right to the assistance of counsel for your defense. That's the assistance of counsel. There's a difference between the word assistance and representation. And it's very, very important. Representation originally had its etymology and its history in old British law dating back to the late 1600s when the aristocracy, the landowners, and the wealthy individuals and didn't want to have to appear personally in a court. They came to this place where they created a definition of the individual that representation, meaning that when somebody was being represented, that means that they had the authority to act in that individual's behavior completely. And that included pleading guilty or not guilty, up to crimes that included capital crimes. And if you wanted to, some people say, well, giving people that authority, they could sell you down the, you know, the Mississippi River, you know, and they regularly do. And what happened was is that to increase the monetary capacity of the commerce of law, they came up with this concept of representation where they represent you. And even in court, now most courts, if you're represented by an attorney, you're not allowed to speak except to terminate your attorney. That's the only thing you're allowed to do because you've hired them. Now, if anybody here was to point out the Sixth Amendment, when the last 10 words in it, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense, where does it say anything about representation? The assistance of counsel, you know, it says, there's an old saying, it says, for a king to succeed at war, he must have many counselors. Well, you're allowed counsel, and it doesn't limit it to just a single person here. It says the assistance of counsel for your defense. And there's a case that just transpired in Los Angeles County Superior Court where 61-year-old widow was accused of manslaughter, wanted to fight the traffic case herself. A drunk pedestrian ran out in the street in front of her vehicle, and Kathy had everything very well on her side, including she had an all points traffic cam and with rear view mirror cam that also had an OBD2 input. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with automotive mechanics, but OBD is onboard diagnostics. That's that little magic whiz bang thing that they plug into that plug to talk to your computer when your check engine light comes on, and your computer turns on the check engine light when it detects a fault. But there are on most of the modern OBD2, there are over 276 parameters, including your vehicle speed, that go into that are available on the OBD2 bus. Now, the little scanners that you buy at the Chief Auto Parts or O'Reilly Auto Parts or Advanced Auto Parts or, you know, any one of the Checker Auto Parts, some of those only have like 6 or 10 or 12 or maybe 26 parameters, but there's a lot more available. And then it also includes on Mercedes, it includes the GPS coordinates of the vehicle and the vehicle track that was available. And if there was an impact on any one of the, if any of the inertia sensors detected an impact, if any one of the proximity sensors on the front, sides, or rear detects a vehicle within 3 meters of the vehicle, meaning that there's a potential impending impact, it takes, and it records the GPS locations and coordinates to all of that, including the speed and the directional heading that the vehicle was going. But in the Los Angeles Superior Court, the judge says, "I'm sorry, you can't represent yourself." And she says, "Why not?" She says, "You realize you're being charged with felony manslaughter here?" And she says, "Oh yeah, I understood that." And he said, "Well, you better get an attorney." She says, "Why?" He says, "Constitutionally, you're," and she cut him off right there. She was recording this on her phone, which she technically wasn't supposed to, but she had a recording inside of her blouse, or inside of her jacket on her blouse pocket. But she says, "I'm sorry, Sonny, but the Constitution guarantees the assistance of counsel, not representation." And she read him the Riot Act. He threatened to throw her in jail. She reminded him that violating her constitutional privilege or rights under policy or law was a felony. And he says, "How is it you seem to know so much?" Well, she, her husband and I, turns out that we actually were at law together at USC many, many years ago. And so we kind of knew each other, and he was an attorney. He was killed in a car accident that took his life about 3 weeks early. He was dying of stage 4 pancreatic cancer already, and somebody ran a light and hit him while waiting in to make a left turn, and broadsided him, and he was killed instantaneously. But she was very, very clear on the concept, and she. The last thing that one of these judges wants to see is a 61-year-old widow on the front page of the LA Times or on the channel ABC Channel 7 Eyewitness News being bludgeoned verbally, emotionally, legally, hopefully not physically, in a courtroom, you know, where she's right. And the judge shut up, and this actually was last week, and she says, "I want to introduce the evidence from my vehicle cam." And because the officer said that she was speeding, failed to yield, and had gone through two red lights before she hit the pedestrian. They ignored the fact that the pedestrian's blood O2 level was 0.21. He had more alcohol in his blood vessels than he had blood plasma. But he ran out into the road, and when she had her expert witness put the vehicle parameters up on the screen, it all went away. Everything went away. The prosecutor tried to get her to agree to a plea bargain, and she explained that the prosecutor, well, actually both prosecutors were female, they explained to her that she needed to get this attorney and to do a plea bargain, and that she might get less than 10 years or maybe even 5 years. Well, the officer, she filed charges against the officer for perjury because the statements he made were summarizations, and that he didn't even check the traffic cam footage, which in Southern California, I know this because I may have been good friends with an individual when they put this program in. They have optical character recognition, and they can see who's driving, and they can pull up their license number and their traffic history and their criminal history and everything. But it also gives you the speed and direction of the vehicle on the traffic cam footage out there. But this officer didn't even check on that. But what happened was that had she agreed to being represented, she probably would have been besmirched with a plea bargain. And at this juncture, one of the things that's extremely important is that the criminal legal aid program wasn't enacted until 1965 under the Office of Economic Opportunity, the OEO. But more so, the attorneys that representation, being represented by an attorney, that didn't begin to occur officially for felony prosecutions until 1963 in a U.S. Supreme Court case of Gideon versus Wainwright. And that's 372 U.S. 335 for those of you who are keeping track of that. But that's when, quote unquote, individuals had the right to an attorney, not the assistance of counsel, the attorney. And they and what happened was that at that juncture, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that in 1963, then that's when that's what all these judges are going back to now. But that's technically the date that they can legally go back to, that somebody has the right to an attorney. And that particular case says if somebody cannot afford one, the court must appoint one at the people's expense, meaning the rank and file of the United States citizens must bear the cost, not the individual, not the defendant. But that, when you hear if you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you, that comes right out of Gideon versus Wainwright, 1963. Okay? But the assistance of counsel comes right out of the Constitution. And the thing that's brutally critical about that is that that was ratified, that was penned and ratified in 1791, and we wouldn't even come to a place where we find that it was 1878 when the first bar association was contrived, and the Sixth Amendment preceded it by 87 years. And so what happens is that there can be no misconstruction about the difference between the assistance of counsel and and being represented. It's extremely important that you as an individual do not get sold a bill of goods. And I'll tell you right now, we've got a half a dozen case students right now that they're recently it's come up that they are not allowed to have the assistance of counsel as per the Constitution. They're required to be representative, and the judiciary on the bench is requiring that they be represented. And they're going, and although they're not saying it out loud, they're going back to the 1963 ruling of Gideon versus Wainwright. And they, the Supreme Court does not have the authority to override the Constitution. Some people have come to the place where they have been sold that bill of goods. They've been told it. Some actually now potentially believe it, but it's wrong. The Supreme Court can clarify a statute or a law, but they cannot override. And at this juncture, the Sixth Amendment, pardon me for a moment, I'm going to get myself a little something to drink here. Thank you all for your patience. Okay. It's very, very important that you as an individual, whether you're a plaintiff in a civil case or a defendant in a civil case or a defendant in a criminal case, you must remember that you have the right to the assistance of counsel. And that means somebody standing beside you, even if it's dear old mom, you know, and the judge does not have the authority or the right to overrule that. We're, you know, I mentioned that we've got about half a dozen cases, students right now that have these challenges. We're looking at all of them as income opportunities, if you catch my meaning. For those of you who are unfamiliar, 42 USC 1983, if you have any questions about it, feel free to either look it up or ask Michael, but I'm going to read it to you. Every person who, comma, under color of statute, ordinance, custom, comma, regulation, comma, or usage of any state or territory or the District of Columbia, comma, subjects or causes to be subjected any citizen of the United States or any other person within the jurisdiction thereof to any deprivation of rights, privileges, immunities secured by the Constitution and laws, shall be liable to the party injured for an action at law, comma, suit in equity, comma, or other proper proceeding for redress, except that any action brought against a judicial officer for an act or omission taken in such officer's judicial capacity, injunctive relief shall not be granted unless, and get this, shall not be left unless a declaratory decree was violated or a declaratory relief was unavailable. For the purpose of this section, any act of Congress applicable exclusively to the District of Columbia shall be considered a statute of the District of Columbia. Now, the judicial officer for an act or an omission for such, okay, now, an act or an omission, that's some, They claim a lot of attitude and latitude with that. They claim, among other things, judicial immunity without restraint. But if we go back to Article 3 of the Constitution, Section 1, Paragraph 1, Line 2, it says the judges of both the Supreme and Inferior Courts shall hold their offices during good behavior. Which makes it very clear that they cannot commit a criminal act from the bench and not be held liable for it. They think they can. And what's happening is that usually the judges, when that's brought up in any court, they get blustery and flustered and like that little itty-bitty fowl called a peacock, they begin to flash feathers that they grow 5, 8, or 10 times the profile that they normally are when they flash their feathers. And they get very upset and they try to badger individuals. And you will get badgered. In fact, you know, you if you ask the question tactfully, it's on the record. And if it, you know, if there's a court reporter there, then that data is recorded for posterity in the court reporter's recording there. Now, because of some of the courts that I've been in, you know, they say you can't some of them say you can't legally record, no recording device should be allowed in there. Well, nowadays that, you know, it used to be if you bought like a little micro cassette recorder or one of those little PRDs, personal recording devices, they'd take it away from you in the courtroom or, you know, when you go. But now everybody's phone, has recording capacity. And what's happening is that actually they say you can't record, but there's no statute that says that. They choose to enforce that. And here's something that's going to make you feel bad. On January 22nd, 2000, I was in a courtroom. We had a difficulty that what happened was is that it was raised to the level of a criminal trial, and court reporter, unbeknownst to me, was invited by the judge, the gown in that particular court, to be the regular court reporter in there, and it was interesting because this particular case was a wrongful carry of or wrongful possession of a firearm case, and when I asked the judge where in the Constitution is excluded my right or this person's right to keep and bear a firearm in that vehicle, let alone your courtroom, all of a sudden, and I still remember the court reporter's name and who she worked for at the time, but what happened was that at that juncture, it was the strangest thing. The court, on that fateful Friday, it was the court reporter's transcript when I paid for him, and I had to pay $214 for him for that day. It was a very short hearing, too. But there a large portion of the conversation, inaudible or misunderstood or slurred, were the words that were in the transcript, not what was actually said. And I quietly sent a CD with a full audio copy to the court reporter, and I had it sent to her through a marshal, and when the marshal came up and made her sign for it, she was at her office, and I had made certain that I was already in her office you know, and when the marshal service says, you know, you need to look at this right away, and she started to play it, and there were, and there was a little sticky note, post-it note saying, would you like to correct the transcript from January 21st, 2000, to amend it to match this? And she told her employee, or the one of the court reporters that worked for her, that the nerve of this person sending all this, and I just stood up and I says, well, would you rather have me forward that to a federal judge for felony prosecution? And all of a sudden she recognized who I was. And and she says, well, I'll see about correcting that. And I says, you'll have it done before I leave today. I can either leave to go back to the court to have this corrected, or I can leave to go over to the federal prosecutor's office, which would please you. And she says, the nerve of you. I says, you know what? I'm not a very good communicator. I'm going to head over to the federal prosecutor. She says, no. And it wasn't 20 minutes, and I had a certified copy of that. And it turns out that she actually had the original, and all she had to do was certify it and have her notary there stamp it. She had the correct one the whole time. I believe she retired less than 2 weeks after that. Apparently there was, because I asked her, I says, you know, should I be looking through all the other court transcripts from the ninth criminal, you know, and from Diane Bull's court? And of all things, I had worked on Diane's reelection campaign, you know, and Diane knew who I was when I was in there. She colored outside the lines. I never worked on her reelection campaign again. In fact, the next term she didn't keep the office. And it wasn't because of anything special that I had done. But Article 3, Section 1, Paragraph 1, Line 2, the judges of both the Supreme and Inferior Courts shall hold their offices during times of good behavior. Okay? So it's very, very clear that without equivocation that the judges are required to behave themselves. And one of them, a U.S. District Court in Florida, I won't say which at this time, in part of the pleadings, because the judge was claiming that she had judicial immunity and the two judges that were being prosecuted had judicial immunity. And the question was asked in the brief in support of the prosecution. And we were on the prosecution at that time. And it was a 42 U.S.C. 1983 complaint. And the brief says, what would the people do, the U.S. public, if they found out that judges believed they could commit criminal offenses from the bench and were immune? What do you think the life expectancy of most judiciary would become? And that very question, I believe, is what got there was a 37-page brief in support of the motion, which was only 4 pages, the motion. But that brief, it got a lot of attention, and things got turned around. And that all was based on the individual, their capacity to represent themselves, and the fact that these judiciary forced representation upon themselves on these two individuals, and were later convicted. And yes, we did quote Ferretta versus California, which an insufficiency of legal counsel causing an individual to be convicted. And at that juncture, we were trying to get that forced. I wasn't involved in the original trials of either of the two individuals that we were pleading for there. And I had not known the individuals more than a year before filing that. But we got that one aspect overturned the original decision, and then one of the two individuals wanted to finish carrying the remainder of that for himself, and he filed some paperwork, and he ended up not getting the decision overturned. In fact, all but got himself rearrested, and then man invented God, made God in his own image, and he was God's gift to the legal profession. If you don't believe me, just ask him. But it took somebody else's assistance to get that overturned and get his tail out of the pencil sharpener, his and his counterpart's tail out of the pencil sharpener for the first time. But what happens is that the point here is that the individual that the court appointed, mandated, would not give them any grace, sold them down the road. Presently, in the saga of Mr. T, we had the same, almost the same exact situation where the public defender that was assigned by the court and subsequently started billing Mr. T was selling him down the road. He was making statements like, "That'll never fly. You don't know what you're talking about. That defense absolutely cannot work." You know, it had a motion to suppress. He says, "You don't have any grounds," and that all of a sudden, when we had the situation corrected so that Mr. T, although we asked the court, demanded the court to show him sui juris, they currently are just showing him improper or improper person. And so what's happened, but at that juncture, this gentleman was reduced to the assistance of counsel. And all of a sudden, his attitude about what could or could not be pushed forward changed drastically. And some of the pleadings that we were working on with Mr. T, we're still in the process of getting to the judge. And this is one of the judges that we're currently working on a 42 U.S.C. 1983 complaint. And you would not believe the whopper of the court order that this particular gavel authored and signed. He totally gave us everything we need for a deprivation of rights under color of law. He literally spelled it out, A, B, C, and so we're working on going forward with that right now with him. And there's a handful of other things in the saga of Mr. T right now that we're working through, case in points, one at a time. And we're hoping to see where this goes. We have a hearing set up for the 29th of February to hear some of these. I don't know if the judge will still be the same judge because at this juncture, we're going to make a motion for him to recuse himself at the same time we file the day after we file the 42 U.S.C. 1983 complaint. And, now see, here's something that's very, very important. Along with filing the complaint for what the judge did wrong, you also have to prove that the judge, this was not a discretionary issue, and that the judge actually committed a crime, or in this case, the felony. And it's very, very important that you, if you're going to pursue this legitimately, that what happens is that if to comply with 42 U.S.C. 1983, you have to show that the act or omission that was taken in judicial capacity was a criminal act. You cannot proceed forward without proving that that is a criminal act. Yet and that 42 U.S.C., one thing I always include there, it is ludicrous for one to consider that a judiciary, the hired help, and I explained the hired help thing, this is a government of the people, by the people, for the people, and I'm working on putting together a brief in support of Judge recusing himself for failure to allow an individual to have a his assistance of counsel. And I'm working on the brief that will point out right now the ABCs of all the criminal acts, and that we point out that it's ludicrous for anyone to accept the possibility that a judge, a member of the judiciary, can commit a felony crime against a U.S. citizen and not be liable. Therefore, it is automatically invalid. Judicial immunity is now automatically invalid. Because if it was ever publicized that a judge can do what he wants, take away an individual's rights or their liberty, just freely at their own discretion without restraint, the value of the judiciary's life would depreciate to zero because individuals would sooner erase the judiciary than even attempt to argue with somebody that might be known to have this. And if more than one judiciary was to consent and support this, and it should ever come to the people of this nation's full attention, their lives might not just become valueless, but terminate, you know. And so in a couple of the briefs that we've put forth in support of that, we've made those points. And in every one of them, the judiciary to date has been removed or resigned from office. And some of them, three of them, took an early retirement and moved to a non-extradition country. And so it's very important that you realize how to, without appearing to attack an individual, strike at the root of the tree so that they know they've done wrong and that anyone who reads it knows they've done wrong, and that regardless of what somebody might consider attempting to do to you, that this is all already on the record and it is nothing that they can escape. You have to let the light of day cast off the shadows of evil. It's very, very important that so that also that whoever gets a copy or a hold of that pleading without equivocation will understand the gravity of the wrongdoing, and not just understand the gravity of the wrongdoing, but also have all the ammunition to prosecute them. So in Mr. T's case, his district court document, DCD, is the order from the judge, is part of the pleading that we're making to the U.S. District Court. Now, you've got to remember, when you're filing in this case against a U.S. District Court judge, he has friends, and they all work in that same jurisdiction that you are required to file in. So, at this juncture, a motion for change of venue may be wise, because you know, these judges, they've been working in the same place for a long time, and you might accidentally be able to reach out to another area. You may not. But a change of venue is something you absolutely want to consider. And like in Mr. T's case, the U.S. District Court's a small court there, and absolutely we're going to need to make a motion for change of venue on the civil action against the judge. And I found out that all the DAGs in this particular jurisdiction, DAG is DAG, Deputy Attorney General. but all the DAGs in this particular jurisdiction are friendly to this particular judge. Now, this judge, I say friendly, they have tender hearts toward him. That tenderization came by the French method. He's real hard on them and beats the snot out of them until they learn to comply with his way of doing business. So they're like Pavlov's dog or the trained flea. They will do what they're supposed to in that environment. So at this juncture, seeking a change of venue is extremely, extremely important. When you ask for the assistance of counsel, you're asking to just to be allowed to have someone else there, and it's not limited to one person, even if the judiciary says it is limited. Objection, Your Honor, it says the assistance, whether that's one or two or three, that's my assistance. And that's, Your Honor, respectfully, I request that you honor the Constitution on this one and allow me to have my assistance. That, no, you're allowed to be represented, okay? And, Your Honor, would that be commensurate with the Gideon versus Wainwright, 1963? And I've actually had two judges that knew about that statute and say, absolutely it is. And I says, then that's it. A person has those rights and assigned by that particular Supreme Court decision, and they can forego those. But the constitutional right and the Bill of Rights cannot be foregone. And at this juncture, we're looking at it strictly as assistance of counsel, and that's very kind of, and in both cases, I made a comment. I said, that's very kind of the court to offer to provide representation at the court and people's expense. But at this time, we'd like to see if we can carry it ourselves, Your Honor, and that's appreciate your kind offer and invitation. And what happens is that you don't tell them, look, you load on slimy, scum-sucking, bottom-feeding piece of swamp moss. You know, you're trying to take away my rights by pushing. We don't say anything like that. You go in with a very constructive attitude and behavior and make certain that the judge realizes that you are appreciative of his attempt at being helpful in the manner and form of Gideon versus Wainwright. But you want to thank him for his grace and stick with your Sixth Amendment rights, okay? And so what happens is that as the, you know, if you never, ever, ever say, Your Honor, you're dead wrong. If the bench is dead wrong, say, Your Honor, I'm going to have to object. I feel like I disagree with that. Could we have the honorable court to either prove that, provide the statute, or could we have the prosecutor provide the statute to support that? And that would make me feel better because right now maybe I'm mistaken, but I don't see that that's lawful. And when you put it to them that way, they are more likely to try to answer your question or rule that, wait a minute, maybe we made a mistake. Okay, with that, my time has come to a close. We're going to open it up now for question and answer. You're not required to adhere to the subject matter topic for the evening, although that's pleasing and very helpful when you do. But if you're not able to, if you had just have a question that you would like answered, it's our honor and privilege to do the best that we can to answer that. And with that, I'll turn the evening back over to Michael Edwards. Thank you, Michael.
Well, thank you so very much, sir. I appreciate that very, very much. Everyone on the call looks to be like they've been here before, so you know the routine. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand, and I will unmute your phone and freely speak with John. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see to the center right of your monitor the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or your question. Underneath, you'll see a place to put your name and some other requested information, then hit Submit. When you hit Submit, it pops up on my end, and I'm very happy to lend my voice to your comment or your question. While we're waiting for this to populate, I want to just share with people that it was, well, about 50 years ago at this time, and then for the following 10 years after that, that I actually was relishing being pulled over by local PD for a traffic offense. I was learning law at that time, being totally unknown to me, and I was, you know, cutting my teeth in the courtroom. One time the judge said, well, you know, if you'd like, we'll appoint you a public defender. And I said to the judge, and I said, I want to understand something, Your Honor. You're a member of the bar, right? And he goes, yeah, you're an attorney, sworn to, you're an officer of the court, right? Yeah. Okay, and this prosecutor over here, this prosecutor is a member of the state bar and an officer of the court, isn't he? He goes, yes, he is. Now, is this public defender going to be independent of the court? Or are they also going to be an attorney, a member of the bar, an officer of the court? Well, no, they would be an attorney. They'd be an officer of the court. So what we're saying is that we've got three individuals here, very highly powered, in this courtroom, holding all the power, and me. Am I correct to understand that? To me, that's like three against one. And he goes, well, you can represent yourself. At that time, I didn't know the difference between representing and presenting. Didn't know any of that, standing in my own right or set. But I did. I proceeded on my own. And I won 70%, something like that, 75% of the cases that were against me. So knowing nothing and just having too much testosterone in my 20s, you know, it can be fun, and you need to learn it. Now, I didn't have the advantage of the jurisdictionary course. I didn't have advantage of people like John. So I just want to share that with you. Again, press star 2 on your keypad. If nobody raises their hands, we're going to go home early, and, you know, it's kind of like, John, nobody wanted to talk to you tonight. Let me go check Freedom's Radio to see if we have anybody there.
Do I need to get Scope?
No.
Scope or some Listermint?
Right. No, Listermint, no. You're doing fine, John. Really appreciate that. And listen, I have more fun going point, counterpoint with John on issues. I really do. Anyways, so we start with Bruce in Texas.
How's everybody doing tonight?
Great.
Good evening. Good evening, Bruce. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
We're doing better than mortal human beings should be mortally allowed to be.
Well, there you go. Thank God. So the question would be, and I think I know, but maybe for other people might not know, at what point in this process, if you have a suit brought against you, if you're criminally charged with something, if you have a traffic incident, whatever it may be, at what point in the process would we bring your team in to assist?
Okay. Re-ask the question a different way. You broke up a little bit there.
Okay. If we become involved in some sort of suit, whether we know about it, somebody files suit on us, brings criminal charges, and I'm assuming these are mostly about criminal cases, at what point in the process should we bring in your team?
I would say immediately, but I'll let Michael respond to that one.
I'm so glad you gave it to me. I'm so glad you did. Bruce, well, let me ask you this question. When is the best time to plant a tree, a shade tree?
As you know, 20 years ago.
You got it. You got it. So having a good relationship with us to begin with, you're known to us and so forth like you are on these calls, that's a great beginning. But the moment something happens, the first question the team will ask you is, Bruce, have you corrected your political citizenship status? Are you a United States citizen?
That's where I was going with this. So
yeah.
That's step one is correct your status.
Yes, and the best time to do that was 20 years ago.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay, then, so you're looking at $5,000 to correct your political citizenship status. Then to bring the team aboard is $20,000, whether it's because you have a seatbelt infraction or they found 5 pounds of cocaine in the trunk of your car, allegedly.
Okay.
Still $20,000. When you have an issue and you got a $275 seatbelt ticket, are we going to charge you $20, or is the team going to charge you $20,000? Well, most likely what the team will do is pivot you, give you direction. We'll try to do it on the open call like tonight where it's free. Anybody can ask any questions on these calls at night. And frankly, we're going to try to help you out, especially if you've been with us for a while and we recognize you. The next caller will tell you that she brought in a friend who didn't pay a dime, but you know they've been helped the entire way. In fact, the team got them to a place where that person that we were helping that did not come to us directly but came through her. They had the winning hand. They had the winning hand. And because the judge threatened him and he was fearful, he didn't play his hand.
Hey, okay. Bruce, I ask you a question, Bruce, to your question?
Mm-hmm.
When do you prepare for a flat tire? And how do you prepare for a flat?
Long before you have the flat tire, you either have a spare and a jack.
Yeah,
or
you buy the spare, you buy the tools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
right.
you also get the education on how to jack the car and how to torque the wheels and whether you torque it with the wheel off the ground or actually touching the ground and, you know, the pattern that you tighten the bolt so that you – when you all of a sudden it happens to you, now did I torque those lug nuts correctly? I don't even know to ask myself that question.
Yeah.
If I haven't.
Nowadays we use torque wrenches and we know what it's supposed to be. But in the old days, I grew up working a farm on weekends and we used to carry 3 and 4 spare tires because we were clearing land and cutting down locust trees, which have ungodly thorns, probably what they stuck all over Jesus when they were crucifying him. And so we had flats every day, and our record was 14 flats in one day. Tractor, trailer, truck, the other truck, you know, it was just crazy.
But you made the point, having the tools, having the parts, the spare tire, the materials. You got that all in advance, and the education on how to use them, you know, and most people don't know that the average torque for a lug nut is 100 or 110 foot-pounds, you know, and those that have a torque wrench can measure that. But if you've got a mid-sized Chevy and you don't know that that's 110 foot-pounds, unless you've actually sat down, taken the wrench that they have, and tested to see if you can actually tighten it to 110 foot-pounds, or if you have to have a jimmy rod to get at that, you don't know that. So to answer your question is the education is the answer would probably be now, wouldn't it?
Yes, I understand what you're saying now. Makes
to be a legitimate observation. Yeah.
Yes. That makes it crystal clear now that you describe it that way.
Okay. Any other questions, Bruce?
Nope. That's awesome. Thank you.
All righty. Hey. Thank you so very much.
Well, by John, the way,
did
Bruce,
do you ever notice that if you pronounce his name phonetically, it could be Bruca? Bruca?
Yeah.
Tami de Berry Vit Bivaka Shahadoni, Mashlamha. Yeah, for those that understand and catch the joke. Bruce, we do have individuals that right now are on those type of programs, and we have regular meetings with them. Sometimes they can only do a half hour. Sometimes we do an hour. Sometimes there's weeks where we may run 3 or 4 or 6 weeks and do an hour a week or more at a time, just because we're making certain that they know how to use the lug wrench, they know how to torque the lug nuts, they know how much has to be there, so that they don't end up with a flat tire and then end up with something potentially even more catastrophic.
Correct.
Okay, gotcha. Back to you, Michael.
Thank you, sir. All right, Miss Jennifer Sue, how do you do?
Oh, I'm pretty cool. so I guess my question is it, can I complain to the court as the assistance of counsel that was harassed and kicked out? Can I complain to the court just on my for that, leaving Leo out of it for the moment?
Actually, Leo was the one that was deprived his assistance of counsel, and you would be authoring an affidavit of fact to what transpired, and including, if it's available, a transcription of the recording or the court report. If there was a court reporter, which is rare lately up in your area, but you would include a copy of that so that, and then you would point out the Sixth Amendment and some of those other facts about 87 years between the time that the American Bar Association was founded and the Sixth Amendment was not just penned but ratified.
Would that be of any value or not really?
If you paid the $513 and filed a 42 U.S.C. 1983 complaint on Leo's behalf, got a copy of his bond, the judge's bond, and some of the jurisdictions up there, the city or the county has a single bond that covers everybody, but you'd get a copy of the bond and in the 42 U.S.C. 1983 complaint, file against that bond and file a lawsuit on Leo's behalf for deprivation of rights under color of law or rule, you know, as we read earlier, and make it an income opportunity for Leo.
Right.
Don't just get the problem corrected. Make a nickel off of it, or maybe even a shiny dime.
So you think it would probably be worth the effort then?
Jennifer Sue, it depends on how big a fish you're currently frying. And I'll tell you, if I had no other fish to fry and Leo came, you know, somebody called me up and introduced me to Leo, if I had the time, I would do that, just out of principle, just to help start uprighting some of what's going on. And to that end, Michael and I are working on compiling a group of briefs that would help individuals that, like yourself, that are already students, you know, not just help yourself, but help others. And with all of the statutes and the case sites and everything, and it's been a teeny weeny bit of work. It's actually a monumental job, but we're working on that right now, and so that we can have a lock knee step monkey motion, show this to the judge, and you deprive this person of his civil rights under color of law, and this is what the rules are. This is what you broke. We're seeking damages. We're seeking compensatory damages in this amount, and we're seeking punitive damages in this amount. And, you know, and if he's, you know, if that local jurisdiction, you know, has $1 million or $10 million bond, you know, go for at least half of it. You know, go for $5 million, you know, for compensatory.
That would have been good to hand to the judge on the day they, if you, you know, kicked me out, basically.
Well, yeah, but see, then, you know, there's there's some challenges with that one, girl. Nonetheless,
I think you're saying I've got the Chase case and the deed cases, and I should just let the other one go for the moment.
Yeah, but the judge might have been singing soprano after you served him like that. You know, is there any other questions, young lady?
Just whether you saw the emails for the Chase case?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I did see those. Mm-hmm. I tell you what, after we get done, could I beg your grace, and can you give Michael a ringle jingle right after the call, right after we finish
sure.
up tonight?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Good night.
All righty. Alrighty. Alright, so next is Freedom's Radio. We have Karen writing in. John, no questions here. I just really appreciate you and all your experience. Thank you for your time. I really enjoy listening to you and learning from you. Best wishes and prayers for you.
Well, Karen on Freedom's Radio, it's an honor and a privilege to serve Liberty, Lady Liberty, beside you and all the other precious honored citizens on these calls. I'll try to live up to your kind accolades. You're very gracious. Thank you.
John, you do realize that Lady Liberty is a pagan goddess, right?
Well, yeah, you and I both know that. But she's still technically...
I know, I'm just playing. I'm sorry.
Okay, you want to give me the raspberries? Okay. You know.
No, I'm not giving you the raspberries. It's just... Listen to just having fun with you.
Well, yeah, but to most individuals, Lady Liberty still stands for what our forefathers, some of our forefathers, intended her to stand for.
Yeah, you know, when you examine Washington D.C. and the buildings, like the statues on top of the buildings, like the White House, et cetera,
It was designed to be the world's greatest home court advantage for diplomats from the U.S. It was laid out to intimidate foreign dignitaries and foreign ministers. It was designed to be the best home court advantage for any type of individual in a case where they're working on diplomacy or, as it were, international cases.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Do we have any other callers this evening?
That's it. Any final comments before we tell people about tomorrow?
Ladies and gentlemen, he who stands for nothing will stand for anything. He who stands for anything stands for nothing. The 56 individuals that signed the Declaration of Independence on that Second Continental Congress, every one of them knew that what they were doing would be considered, if they did not succeed, they knew that they would be could be treated as treasonous and forfeit not just their wealth but their lives. And every one of those individuals that got together and decided and purposed that they were going to sign that Declaration of Independence, regardless of how much fun they could possibly have for actually doing that, they stood upright and pledged in that moment of signing. That wasn't just a signing of the Declaration of Independence, but that was a pledge of their lives and their commitments that no matter what transpired, they were on for the, they signed on board, and if it cost them their life, they knew that was what they were signing on board. How many of us, if there were a roll call vote taken of all those individuals that signed the Declaration of Independence, would be willing to stand up and be counted as number 57?
A somber question indeed.
It's an honor, Philip, to serve beside you. Thank you.
We have a sneak last minute in here. Mike from Las Vegas, Nevada. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, can you hear me okay?
No, not
yes,
a word.
Yes, Michael, thank you.
Not a word. Well, thank you, John. Anyway, people, we don't teach or read the history anymore, but 1774 and 1775 is when they started removing these so-called justices or magistrates from the courts around Boston. And they had to go back to Boston for the protection of the British Army because they removed them at gunpoint. That's something people need to study and read because we have the right to remove them. That's what the Constitution gives us. Don't be afraid to express your rights.
You are so spot on accurate.
Most people, though, John, they live in fear, even though they say they don't. You put them in a Cessna and get them off the ground, say, well, take it, and they will just freeze up or fly upside down or turn it into the ground. They have no comprehension of what they're doing, just like today the Google this and Google that don't even know how to change a tire on a car. So they're
isn't that kind of scary? You know, it's no joke. We stopped to help somebody that they were sitting on their hood and they were Googling how to change the tire on their Nissan.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, well, and that's our fault. You know, as parents, that's all our fault. We've left the generations behind us, and maybe our parents did some of the leaving behind, and, you know, we had to do some catching up. But, yeah, it's so true.
That's America today.
Thank you for your input,
I just
Mike.
Thought I'd throw that in for you. That was that one case was Ferretta versus California, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Because I have a guy that's sitting in jail right now for ineffective. Well, he had a drunk for a lawyer, and the guy had already been administratively charged by the bar. But by the time I got around to talking to him, it was too late. So,
if you look that up on a search engine, you know, like Google, it's Ferretta versus California, 422 U.S. 806, and it's a 1975 Supreme Court decision.
1975. Okay.
Yeah, 1975. It's 422 U.S. 806.
Okay, thank you. 422.
Yeah, 422 U.S. 806. Ferretta versus California, Ferretta.
Well, I'll see if I can't help them out. Right now, I can't do much of anything with this leg like this except try to exercise and keep it coming back to normal, which I don't know if it'll ever be normal again, but at least I can walk.
Hey. You know what? I can still walk a little bit, although I'm confined to a wheelchair most of the time. And it was murder turn 23. Michael, I don't know what I'm going to do when I hit 26. You know, some of those expiration gates are coming and going. And, Yeah, this morning I had a horrible time getting out of bed because the pain in my right leg was so bad and my back. But, you know, scraping that bed off the back, you know, is, you know, you got to have a big putty knife for that, you know, and,
yeah.
And you got to remember, remember that, you know, 26 is still a few mile markers off. You know, it's you're as young as you feel.
Yeah. Well, I'll just go out and gather you some wild leaf lettuce and boil it down. And when it gets gray or black and sticky, you know, tar-like, that's when you can strain it all out and just eat it by the tablespoon. It's the same as morphine without the side effects.
Hey, there you go. Thank you for your input tonight, and thank you for being here, Mike. Take care.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. We need
right.
more people on.
And
thank you.
With that, back to Michael Edwards. Go ahead.
All right. Let me just check his radio one more time. Yeah, tomorrow we're going to have Michael Edwards here. We'll be talking about the limited liability company. And John, the law that was passed January 1st regarding LLCs reporting who the beneficiaries are in the process, which of course affects both you and me, in that we both have acquired Mr. Slevin's limited liability company. We'll be talking about that to some degree. The suggestion that I propose is that and it's really the reason that I had worked with Mr. Slevin was because this dovetails perfectly with Justice Beshear's golden horseshoe. And that is, rather than having the myself as one who is the beneficiary, or someone like yourself or Bob Raven or whoever, to go back to the original plan that Justice Beshear had, which was to have two foreign grantor trusts be the 50-50 owner, if you would, a beneficiary of the LLC. Now, in lieu of that, since that golden horseshoe is such an expansive, you know, for some expensive proposition to begin with, especially starting out, at the very minimum is to have two charitable religious trusts be the beneficiary, if you would. So you have the LLC doing commerce, and even though Mr. Slevin's LLC is a non-taxable commerce, if you would, it's now the beneficiaries are two non-taxable entities, charitable religious trusts of the LLC. And then once the steam gets going and capital has moved, money has moved, then you can complete that by having those as pass-throughs or be bought out by the two foreign grantor trusts in the completion of the Golden Horseshoe. That's my recommendation. If you have any thoughts on that would be great. If not, we'll be talking about that tomorrow either way.
Well, thank you. I I think we ought to have a conference call with Justice Beshear, you and I. Mm-hmm. But probably not tonight. We've got Jennifer Sue Hansen coming on.
Right.
Right.
All righty. Okay, thank you all for joining us this evening. We'll see you tomorrow night, prayerfully, until whoop. One more slipped in. Golly, gee, somebody left the door open. Brent, go ahead.
Well, you just brought up another point, and I thought I'd just add to it. Yeah, I looked extensively at that new regulation, and there is exemptions for religious organizations. So as long as that LLC is owned by a religious organization, there shouldn't be any issue with having to file that.
Good. Would you do me a favor and grab the specific reference to that for me and get it in front of us, please?
Sure.
That would be of great, great help.
Maybe join tomorrow night's call.
Yeah, hey, that would be a novel idea.
Yeah, what a novel idea. Well, there you go. Okay. With that, Michael, I'm done. The Father's blessings be upon you.
All right, good night, everyone. Till tomorrow night. Be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.